session number 9752, reel 14.
Colonel Dillon, reel 14. You were saying you decided to become a regular because the army life appeared more attractive than the alternative of going back to the collieries and being a mining engineer.
Yes.
Did you not think of taking some other profession other than being a mining engineer? I mean, you could have gone into other areas, I suppose.
I think what appealed to me was the life amongst other people, one's own ideas, standing in life. Whatever other kind of job one went into, there's always the business of living by yourself or living with your family. In the army, you're like a great brotherhood. In the mess, for instance, you all knew each other. You all had communal games, and communal work, and so forth. And it appealed very much. In addition to which, I hadn't, as I thought at the time, I didn't have to sit for any exams or anything like that. I would have had to do as a mechanical engineer or that sort, or a lawyer or so on. Little did I know that I had two of the stiffest exams in the world to pass for promotion before I could get on. But
were you a captain at this time, or still?
No, I was a captain, but I lost the pip. I went back to lieutenant.
Did you resent that when you were taken back to being a lieutenant?
No, not really, because it was only fair. You see, I was commissioned at the age of 18. Which is a year younger than the youngest Sandhurst candidate, the ordinary regular army candidate. And so it gave me an unfair advantage over them. And so I lost a year of seniority so as to be on the level of other people of my own age.
When you decided to go into the army, did you want to stay with the tank corps, or were you thinking, or would you have thought of going back to the Northumberland Fusiliers?
Oh no, I was firm, firmly a tank man from then on. Oh yes.
Which tank unit did you join?
In the first place, I didn't join any. I was, owing to my experience in the field, I was put in charge of the Reconnaissance Officers' School, Central Schools of Bovington. There were training in reconnaissance officers for future battalions.
This was as a lieutenant, you?
I was a lieutenant, yes. What, then, of course, what, it...
What did you do there? What program did you institute to inculcate the officers with the necessary qualities?
Teaching them how to read maps, all sorts of other nations too, like the French Hachette maps, how to use a compass and get yourself about in the dark, how to ride a motor bicycle with a bidding rail tied on behind, which wasn't always very easy, various tips about countryside, uses of the countryside, and so on. Quite a lot to learn when you get down to it. It wasn't a long course, only about 3 weeks, I think, something like that. But
and when did you start this? In 1919?
It would be November 18. In 1919, yes, that's right, yes.
And when were you attached to your first real unit, so to speak?
Well, from there I went... the reconnaissance school was broken up because, like all the other battalions that had been hastily reformed, it was redundant, so it was closed. So I was out on a limb that being in the Silver Ring, as you might say, in the Central Schools establishment, I got posted to the Armoured Car School. And I stayed in the Armoured Car School for 5 years.
As an instructor?
Teaching people to drive, teaching them the insides of the vehicle and how everything worked. I knew a lot about it. And of course the modern car defeats me completely. But in those days I could pull a motor car to pieces, including the magneto, entirely, and start again. So I knew it all. And I had to organize instructors and teach them, because if you didn't watch them, they taught the most outrageous things. And I spent 5 very happy years there and got extra duty pay for it. So I was able to get by without too much money.
You were still committed then to the idea of tanks and armoured cars?
Oh, yes. I, at that time, by that 5 years, tank corps had become the Royal Tank Corps, not the Royal Tank Regiment, that came later. So it became the Royal Tank Corps, and we were all transferred to it. It was rather amusing, before the Royal Tank Corps was announced, it was rather amusing to watch a parade on the depot parade ground, when there'd be 20 or 30 officers, everyone in a different uniform.
Would you still be in your Northumberland Fusilier badge? Did you feel that armoured cars had any advantages over tanks, or vice versa?
Each had a separate role to play. See, the armoured car can beat it like hell, and across the desert, for instance, it had it all the way. The tank is an infighting vehicle. I had tremendous trouble when I was in India. I was the principal technical officer for the tank regiment at GHQ, Army Headquarters, I think it was. And I had awful trouble there because they wanted a new design of armoured car for the frontier roads. Now, you probably know what the frontier roads look like, as well as I do, all serpentine and winding in and out, no place to turn. And they proceeded to try the most outrageous things. I fought bravely against it. I said, what you want is a London taxi, because it'll turn in its own length, and get that and armour it, or make it strong enough. No, it wouldn't have it. It had to have 2 guns. What's the good of a machine with only 1 gun? So I said, well, you get stuck on a mountain road, what are you going to do? Oh, well, they won't get stuck, see. Couldn't get anywhere. Eventually, they produced the Guy Armoured Car, which was the thing about the size of this room. It was a 6-wheeler, and weighed about 8 tons, and it was so heavy that it had to have power-assisted steering. As for turning it on the mountain road, it was bloody like if you got it going one way. But there again, the way one came up against stupid wall of defence. We were talking about tanks as offensive weapons. I managed to get some tanks up to India by virtue of my position. I got my colonel to press hard for it, and we got out some experimental Vickers Lloyd tanks, which were 2-man jobs. And they were splendid little chaps. They would turn around in their own lengths and go up a place that a mule would go up, and marvellous. And eventually I think the companies out there, a lot of them were rearmed with these tanks instead of armoured cars.
What speed would they go at?
Oh, they'd do about 15 miles an hour, which was outrageous for those days. This was 1930, 31. You see, armoured car is very nice. I have trouble in Delhi There's an armored car company in Lahore. Well, it can be in Delhi in 2-3 hours. The tanks can't.
How fast would they go then, in comparison?
The armored car. Well, the Rolls Royce armored cars would do about 60. We didn't encourage that because the tires kept blowing up. But that is the difference between the two. One is a weapon of offence, and the other really is a law and order keeping machine. It's true that I think the Duke of Westminster had some armored cars in the Western Desert, and he did some marvellous stuff against the Senussi. But that's rather an exception.
Did you ever regret having stayed on as a regular?
Oh no. Oh no, I enjoyed it. I won't say every moment, but I enjoyed the life entirely. It's a brotherhood. And also, if you're posted to foreign parts, you've got the edge on people who do the trip privately. They've always got the army to fall back on. For instance, if you want to go down to the local bazaar, it's not normally safe for people to go. You go down to the exit of the bazaar in an armored car and have a couple of troopers with you, and nobody will touch you.
The First World War itself, you've said it did some good to, in the way it advanced your character quicker than perhaps it would have done, and gave you responsibility at an early age. Did it do you any harm, the things you'd seen, the experiences and the wounds? You were wounded two or three times. Did it do any lasting harm? Did you feel it had been worthwhile?
Do you mean psychologically?
In any way that you can put your finger on, really?
I don't think so. I think psychologically it's just a marvellous education to feel that you'd been put up against some frightful obstacles and surmounted them. I don't think it made one, in a sense, brutalized one at all. It's true, one saw the most frightful things. But somehow or other, nature gives a sort of skin round you to protect you from the effect, the psychological effect of such things. And doesn't even worry me now. If I find somebody with his bowels all hanging out, I think it's a bother and push them back, but that's all.
Just a couple more points. I believe you have some observations you want to make about the nature of a battlefield in real life.
The general public have an entirely false concept of what a battlefield is like, mainly due to the work of pictorial artists. I have in mind the pictures of the charge by the Scots Greys, by Lady somebody or other, a famous picture of all the horses with their eyes shining, mouths open, and frothing away, and all the men cheering and waving arms and swords and so forth. The same theory goes through the public's idea of an ordinary land battle. At least, as I see it, it's entirely different. The beginnings of a large battle are very thrilling, I must admit, because I've been in one, and the sound of this dead silence of the night, well, early morning probably, is when the birds are beginning to chirp, and this colossal barrage breaks out. The noise of it makes the ordinary thunder compared to the ordinary sound of its own length, it sounds like a flea's fart. It's so terrific, the roar and noise of millions of shells going through the air at the same time. At the same time, unfortunately, people who got to do the attack are not running about cheering. They may have fixed bayonets, they may not. It depends what stage of the war we were in. The unfortunate people who have got to make the attack crawl out of their trench when the 0 hour whistle blows and this barrier has begun, and have to crawl forward first of all through their own barbed wire, which is not very easy unless they've made gaps in it beforehand. Then of course there's a machine gun fire from the other side, and the unfortunate attackers are crawling on their bellies going from shell hole to shell hole, and eventually with luck get through the other side, all completely disorganized and just ones and twos. Some won't have got there at all because they're held up by the barbed wire. Others have got through and will be engaged in bombing their way up and down the captured trench so as to try and get control of it. Then you will find that the next company to yours has got much further through, and so that helps you forward because the Germans start withdrawing. The whole atmosphere stinks of cordite and gas. There are dead lying everywhere, wounded being patched up by their comrades or by the stretcher bearers, and a general air of confusion and dust. There's no glamour about it, whatever. It's hard, unpleasant work. I suppose the glamorous idea has to be kept before the public, otherwise nobody would join the army at all. So that's how it is.
Another thing I believe you've got some remarks about is, although you as a reconnaissance officer would travel on foot with the tanks, or behind the tanks rather, and once or twice you have to go forward and communicate with them, I believe you've got some points to make about officers, tank officers, who led their tanks from in front of the tank or at the side of the tank. I wonder if you could...
This was became a habit because early on everybody of course wanted a medal of some sort, and one chap who was in the early days of tanks in rather a sticky place, his tank was kept getting stuck, and so he got out and with a masked torch guided the driver on along a track to himself, and he got the Military Cross for his efforts in the successful tank action. Well, this got around. The thing to do to get the Military Cross was to get out and lead your tank. A lot of people did it when it was quite unnecessary, as was the case when I was at the Aerospace.
Could you tell us about that? Because one thing we missed out of the tape, so if you could...
Well, I was sent up to the Aerospace to get a bit of experience as a reconnaissance officer, which I did. And
this is before you were wounded at Lens...
Yes, it was before.
We had the chronology wrong earlier, didn't we?
I got the chronology wrong, probably. But anyway, I was attached to one of the battalions, not my own, which was fighting in front of Arras, and as usual, following the battle along, and it went very well. There was very little opposition. We got to our objective, just as the tanks got there, I saw a tank in front of me was hit. I went up to it and found it had a large piece of shell knocked out of it, its armor on one side, and out in front of the tank was its commander lying dead. He'd been killed leading his tank. And there was not the least need to do so, because the going there was perfectly good, and it was the most unfortunate thing to have happened. Well, that is why I rather strong on not getting out unnecessarily, and trying to guide yourself about by your compass, because using the compass, a thing we've not touched on in my memoirs, it was quite an important part of tank drill. You see, it's terribly difficult, especially if it's still dark, to find out where you're going in the tank. The visibility is very limited indeed. So unless you've got a compass, you don't know whether you're going front, back or sideways. In fact, at the battle on the 8th of August 1918, as my colonel and I were walking up the road behind the tanks, we met one tank coming towards us, looking very fierce. And he opened his lid and said, "Take care, sir, you're right in the middle of German lines." And we had to say, "Sorry, chum, you're right in the middle of your own lines." He got his compass maladjusted, and he was 180 degrees out. So he got back.
What happened to you after you'd taken over the tank at Arras?
Oh, nothing. The fighting had finished. I drove back with it to wherever it was, rallying after the battle together.
You didn't carry on going forward. It was all over.
Oh, no. We went down a couple of hundred yards, I think, something like that. That is all.
Did you have any difficulty steering it or giving commands? Had your training been...
Well, of course, we all knew the inside of a tank at the back of our hands. I mean, it was... everyday job being inside and out for them. The driver was the chap who really drove it. The only job the officer had to do was to put the brakes on whichever side was necessary to slow up that track for turning purposes. Anybody could do that. Anyway, I got them back to the rallying point and said goodbye, I'm off for home. Had a drink somewhere.
Did they try and discourage officers from getting out of the tanks? Did they stop giving them medals?
No, it didn't stop giving them the medals, but it was frowned upon as a general practice, so that people didn't think that they would get a military cross for doing so.
So they'd only get out in cases of real need?
Yeah, in case of real need, yes. That's a different matter altogether.
And then, perhaps finally, I believe you've just got an amusing story about the guards and a manoeuvre.
This really has nothing to do with World War One. It is a case of manoeuvres being held somewhere near Purbright and near Aldershot. And a friend of mine, whose name was Duncan, was commanding a company of light tanks. And they were fighting a mock battle, and the enemy were the guards, and they came over a rise, this company in line, and Duncan spotted the guards in front of the enemy, so he called out over his television, radio, "Company, guards, enemy in front, guards in front, at guards and uppermen," which is a plagiarism of the famous Duke of Wellington's exhortation to the guards at Waterloo. At guards and uppermen. Let's have a rest.
Thank you very much.